You think she leaves the impression, not mine, but I've heard this, that she has a chip on her shoulder.
I think that's BS. You know, people say she's got a chip on her shoulder. That's like, well, she's being the B word, which is a classic epithet against women whenever they sound aggressive or they really state their mind. I don't think that's true at all.
You don't think?
Maybe I know her too well. She doesn't have a chip on her shoulder.
You don't think she's a black militant?
Black militant? Well, I'm a black militant, John. The Tribune hired me anyway. Seriously.
Really?
In the 60s, they said, well, I can hire that Clarence Page, but it might be a little militant for the Tribune.
Because of that, I
went to Brooks Brothers and bought a suit, so I went halfway.
John, that's for me.
You've heard it all. Here they come again. These clowns are talking about Obama's wife possibly being a black militant. She supports someone who is running to be an administrator to the Imperial Order. Capital financial construct up the behind. Deeply embedded in the imperial policies and domination of the order. Global imperialism is all you have to administer with either color neutral tap dance shoes or stilettos or the cowboy boots of Boy George. Whatever the case, if you are one of them and someone who stands behind them, militancy for humanity is the last thing you are. But hey, what do you expect from the McLaughlin Group? Deeply embedded in the Matrix. You know what time it is, slave time. Check it. You're listening to 103.3, 104.1, uploaded by Skid in Santa Cruz, 93.7. Check out my comrades in arms out of South America, propagandapress.org, and click into radioforall.net, the universe. Tonight, we're going to deal with the blue pill that's swallowed within the blue screen of the Matrix by much of humanity. We got all that and hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave of Oath.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
This very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.
A scorching July afternoon, as the temperature creeps towards 118 degrees in a quiet suburb of East Phoenix, Rick Hustadt sits at his computer with the blinds drawn, smoking a cigarette while his wife Sue watches television in the living room. Mr. Hustadt chats online with what appears on the screen to be a tall, slim redhead. He's never met the woman outside of the computer world of Second Life, a well-chronicled digital fantasy land with more than 8 million registered residents, quote-unquote, who get jobs, attend concerts, and date other users. He's never so much as spoken to her on the telephone, but their relationship has taken on a curiously real dimension. They own two dogs, pay a mortgage together, and spend hours shopping at the mall and taking long motorcycle rides. This May, when Mr. Hustadt, 53, needed real-life surgery, the redhead cheered him up with a private island that cost her $120,000 in virtual world's currency, or about $480 in real-world dollars. Their bond is so strong that 3 months ago, Mr. Hustadt asked Janet Spillman, the 38-year-old Canadian woman who controls the redhead, to become his virtual wife. The woman he is legally wed to is not amused. Quote, "It's really devastating," says Sue Hustadt, 58, an export agent for a shipping company who has been married to Mr. Hustadt for 7 months. Quote, "You try to talk to someone or bring them a drink, and they're having sex with a cartoon," unquote. This, sisters and brothers, slaves, is a Ruins of Empire segment that we're about to explore, called Into the Blue Screen Matrix, the reality, quote-unquote, of the industrialized world's cyberspace make-believe. We're about to explore just how deep many are within this Matrix. Continuing, Mr. Hoosterstrats plays down his online relationship, assuring his wife that it's only a game. While many busy people can't fathom the idea of taking on another set of commitments, especially imaginary ones, Second Life and other multiple player games are moving into the mainstream. With some 30 million people now involved worldwide, there is mounting concern that some are squandering, even damaging their real lives by obsessing over their second quote-unquote ones. There's always been a concern with video games, but a field of study suggests that the boundary between virtual worlds and reality may be more porous than experts previously imagined. Nearly 40% of men and 53% of women who play online games say their virtual friends were equal or better than their real-life friends, according to a survey of 30,000 gamers conducted by Nick Yee, a recent PhD graduate from Stanford University. More than a quarter of the gamers said that the emotional highlight of the past week occurred in the computer world. According to the survey, which was published in 2006 by Massachusetts Institute of Technology Press Journal, Presence, quote, "There's a fuzziness that's emerging between the virtual world and the real world," unquote, says Edward Casanova, associate professor at the Department of Telecommunications at Indiana University, Bloomington. Hold on a sec. So look, we have a 53-year-old man, Rick, married 7 months to a 58-year-old woman, Sue. Yet Rick is living, quote-unquote, out his dreams in his make-believe world with a 38-year-old woman, his virtual wife, that he's never met in real life. She's from Canada. And this is devastating his real relationship. As Sue said, quote, "You try to talk to someone or bring them a drink, and they'll be having sex with a cartoon," unquote. Rick's response is, "It's only a game." 30 million people plugged in to this game that has become an important part of this matrix out, mouse click away fantasy land for many who are obsessing over their second life. Clearly something else is going on when you're mouse clicking out of the real world and delving deeply in to the fantasy one. 40% of men, 53% of the women surveyed who played online games say their virtual friends were equal or better than their real life friends. More than 25% of the 30,000 gamers said that their emotional highlight of the past week was in the computer world. People are being logged or are logging out from true human friendship and bondage, connections and responsibilities, and the commitments that go with it. Fear, intolerance, religions help play this role of delusion, these theological supremacist belief systems, and on and on and on. Rick, a burly man with a long gray ponytail, thick sideburns, and a salt and pepper handlebar mustache, Mr. Hoosterstrat looks like the cross between a techie and the Grateful Dead fan that he is. He drives a motorcycle and wears faded black Harley Davidson t-shirts around the house. A former college computer graphics teacher, Mr. Hoosterstrat was never much of a game enthusiast before he discovered Second Life. But since February, he's been spending 6 hours a night and often 14 hours at a stretch on weekends as Dutch Hornbreck, his 6'9" muscular motorcycle riding cyber self. The character looks like a younger, physically enhanced version of him. a biker with a long black ponytail, strong jaw, and thick handlebar mustache. In the virtual world, he's a successful entrepreneur with a net worth of about $1.5 million in the site's currency, the linen, which can be earned or purchased through Second Life's website at a rate of about 250 linens per U.S. dollar. He owns a mall, a private beach club, a dance club, and a strip club. He has 25 employees, online persons known as avatars who are operated by other players, including a security guard, a mall concierge, and a manager and assistant manager, and the erotic dancers at the club. He designs bikinis and lingerie and sells them through his chain store, Redheaded Lovers. Quote, "Here, you're in total control," he says, moving his avatar through the mall using the arrow keys on his keyboard. Virtual worlds like Second Life have fast become a testing ground for the limits of relationships, both online and off. In the game, cybersex, marriage, and divorce are common. Avatars have sued one another, as well as the site's parent companies, Linden Lab, and real-life courts for in-game grievances such as copyright infringement and property disputes. The sites now has more than 8 million registered residents, quote-unquote, up to 100,000 in January 2006. The number of active users is closer to 450,000, according to Linden Lab's most recent data. Quote, "A typical gamer," unquote, "spends 20 to 40 hours a week in the virtual world."
Time is always against us. Please, take a seat there. Part of a trace program. It's designed to disrupt your input-output carrier signal so we can pinpoint your location.
What does that mean?
It means buckle your seatbelt, Dorothy, because Kansas is going bye-bye.
Academics have only recently begun to intensively study the social dynamics of virtual worlds, but some say they are astonished by how closely virtual relationships mirror real life. Quote, "People respond to interactive technology on social and emotional levels much more than we ever thought," unquote, says Brian Reeves, a professor of communications at Stanford University. Quote, "People feel bad when something bad happens to their avatars, and they feel quite good when something good happens," unquote.
Have you ever had a dream, Neo, that you were so sure was real? What if you were able to wake from that dream? How would you know the difference between the dream world and the real world?
This can't be.
Be what? Be real?
It's going into replication.
Hey, Pop. Still nothing.
It's gone. It's gone.
Tank, we're going to need a signal soon.
Fibrillation.
APOC, location. Targeting almost there.
He's going into arrest.
Lock. I got him. Now, Tank, now.
On a neurological level, players may not distinguish between virtual and real-life relationships. Recent studies suggest in an experiment conducted at the University of Washington Institute for Learning in Brain Sciences. Test subjects were hooked up to neural imaging machines while they played a simple computer game in which they moved colored discs to form a pattern. When told that they were playing with a person rather than a computer, participants showed increased activity in areas of the brain that govern social interaction. Other experiments show that people socializing in virtual worlds remain sensitive to subtle clues like eye contact. In one study, participants moved their avatars back if another character stood too close, even though the space violation was merely virtual, says Jeremy Bellison, director of Stanford's Human Virtual Interaction Lab, which was created 5 years ago to study social behavior in virtual worlds. Quote, "Our brains are not specialized for 21st century media," says Professor Reeves. "There is no switch that says process this differently because it's on a screen," unquote. These are the cyber friends in an age of human isolation. These friendships in cyber world are strictly at the keyboarder's operator's discretion when one wishes not to deal with a cyber friend, wife, husband, girlfriend, boyfriend, whatever. Simply log out. A cyber friend in New York doesn't have to worry about a cyber friend in Oregon asking for a car ride home if their car broke down at 3 a.m. in the morning. Uncomfortable topics are merely a mouse click away. This is, slaves, the dehumanization of people locked into the prism of the virtual world, locked into the matrix. If the first physical world's not working out, simply log out into the second life, where spouses make love to a cartoon and people's make-believe heaven is being found in the cyber world. Saturday afternoon in July, Mr. Hoopestrat, of course this is Rick, Dutch, decides to go to the beach. He lights a cigarette and enters Second Life, one of 42,752 people logged on at the time. Immediately he gets an instant message from Tanaj Jackalope, his Second Life wife, this is the girl from Canada, saying she'll be right there. They meet at their home, a three-story modern-looking building on a grassy bluff overlooking the house, then head to his beach club by teleporting or instantly moving to a new screen by typing in a location. A full-blown dance party is underway. A dozen avatars' digital representation of their live players gyrate on the sand, twisting their hips and waving their arms. Several dance topless, and some are fully nude. Dutch gets pelted with instant messages. "What took you so long, Dutch?" meaning Rick. A dancer asks, "Howdy, boss man," an avatar named Whiskey Girl says. Before discovering Second Life, Mr. Hookerstrap had bounced between places and jobs, working as an elementary school teacher and a ski instructor, teaching computer graphics, and spending 2 years on the road selling herbs and essential oils at Renaissance fairs. Along the way, he picked up a bachelor's degree in education from Arizona State University and took graduate courses in education and instructional technology at the University of Wyoming and the University of Arizona. He currently works as a call center operator for Vigant Incorporated, a large corporation that outsources calls for the government and private companies. He makes $14 an hour. So here he's working for a corporation that outsources jobs to their version of a virtual world. You know, places like India. But it's real. And they materially exploit the people of India and the people of America by outsourcing these jobs like they're supposed to get material cash. So in essence, he's just getting whipped up in the real world, meaning Rick or Dutch. So what does he do? He transports into Second Life, where he's a big man, quote unquote. And while he's over as a big man in Second Life, of course, this precludes him from fighting the real fight here. Basically, he's emulating the people he's getting crushed by in Second Life. This is how bad things have gotten. Continuing, Mr. Hookerstrat learned about Second Life in February while watching a morning news segment. His mother had just been hospitalized with pancreatic cancer. She died 2 weeks later, and he wanted a distraction. He was fascinated by the virtual world's free-willing Vegas-like atmosphere. With his computer graphics background, he quickly learned how to build furniture and design clothing. He upgraded his avatar, buying the fine stomach muscles. A furry chest and special hair that swayed when he walked. Another missing autonomy was also available for purchase. Before long, Mr. Hookerstrat was spending most nights and weekends acting out his avatar's life. So hey, you get your ass kicked in this world, hey, there's always a second life. Oh yeah, and a second wife. Continuing. When Mr. Hookerstrat was diagnosed with diabetes and a falling gallbladder a few months ago, he was homebound for 5 weeks. Some days he played from 5:45 in the morning until 2 in the morning, eating in front of the computer and pausing only for bathroom breaks. During one marathon session, Mr. Hookerstrat met Tanaj, Janet spelled backwards, while shopping. This, of course, is the lady from Canada. They became fast friends, then partners. A week later, he asked her to move into the small apartment he rented in Phantom Island, an area of Second Life. In May, they married in a ceremony in a garden overlooking a pond. She wore a strapless white dress that she bought at Second Life's yard sale, and he wore a tuxedo. 30 of their avatar friends attended. This is a virtual Ken and Barbie for grown-ups. This is regression. Regression, regression, regression. Quote, "There's a huge trust between us," says Miss Spillman. This is Janet Tanaj from Canada, a divorced mother of two who works in office sales in Calgary, Alberta, and began logging on to Second Life in January. "We'll tell each other everything. That intimacy hasn't spilled into real life," quote unquote. "They never speak and have no plans to meet, aside from the details they share over Second Life's instant messages. Each knows little about the other beyond what's posted on their brief online user profiles." Mr. Hookerstrat's real-life wife is losing patience with her husband's Second Life. Quote, "It's sad. It's a waste of human life," unquote, says Mrs. Hookerstrat, who is dark-haired and heavy-set with smooth, pale skin. "Everybody has their hobbies, but when it's from 6 in the morning until 2 in the morning, that's not a hobby. That's your life."
What is real? How do you define real? If you're talking about what you can feel, what you can smell, and taste, and see, then real is simply electrical signals interpreted by your brain. This is the world that you know. The world as it was at the end of the 20th century. It exists now only as part of a neural interactive simulation that we call the Matrix. You've been living in a dream world, Neo. This is the world as it exists today.
Dispatch?
Yes, it is.
We got an emergency, just had a derailment. We've got an explosion. Oh, it's around Teresito Vallejo, CP Rail. We just had a derailment. We've got an explosion. Over.
Okay. Do you know what kind of chemicals are on board, sir?
We've got hazardous material, and I can smell stuff now.
911 emergency. Hello? Hello?
We're out at Teresito Vallejo. 625 37th Street Southwest.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what's going on. Something sparked and flew. It reeks in our backyard. We're going to try to get out of the house.
Okay,
What is it? It's bad. We're going to try to go to the neighbors.
Okay,
what is it?
Wait.
Kelsey. Come in here. It smells really bad. I don't know if the train blew up.
Okay,
or...
yeah, there is a train derailment there.
Okay.
Okay.
Where's Kelsey at? God.
Do you have everybody in the room?
No, we don't. She sent my daughter out.
Outside?
Yell at her. Kelsey.
1224, I thought. Kelsey, can you come back? Do you have everybody there now?
No, we don't. My daughter isn't there. I don't have anything on. They're all dressed, and she sent her out. But it smells really bad outside.
Okay, yeah, just...
Is she here?
No, honey.
Huh?
She's not here.
Here, you stay on the phone. I had to get some clothes on.
Ma'am? My daughter ran out the front door.
She ran out? How old is your daughter?
She's 12. Is she going to die out there? You guys have to hurry, please.
Just stay inside, okay? Tell everybody
she's
in the house.
Her lungs. Oh, my God. I'm sorry, kid. I didn't know what to do. No, she's going to die. She can't breathe out there. Where are you guys? It's getting bad.
Okay. Are your doors closed?
Yeah, we're closed up, but I can... We can't breathe. My daughter's going to die out there.
January 18th, 2002, 112 car train just outside of Myatt, North Dakota derailed. The train conductor called 911, who you first heard, and reported that hazardous material had been spilled with this derailment. 240,000 gallons of anhydrous ammonia spilled out of the train. The vapor fog covered the town. Hundreds of people were hospitalized. One died. Clear Channel owned all six commercial radio stations in Myatt, North Dakota. They did not break into any on-air live programming to announce the emergency. The town's emergency alert system simply failed. Officials and residents called the station, but to no avail. Why? Because the music was being piped in by Clear Channel from out of state, by these virtual community-based radio stations that they had set up. They're not real stations anymore. Clear Channel gobbles up these stations, and then they just pipe them in, to save money, of course, and pretend like they're your local community stations. But in your time of need, guess what? Large doses of this toxic fog can shut down your respiratory system. CSJB 910 was the town's designated emergency broadcast station, which was one of the stations owned by Clear Channel. But no one could get through to them because no one was at the station. It's simply a virtual station. Living in this virtual corporate matrix can only last so long until you really face the real world. January 18th, 2002, the people of Mayotte faced the real world. So as drones define and redefine what real or what is not real, and are being consumed in a blue screen cyberspace haze that they call a life. Is that real? Well, all one has to do is wait until you need real human-to-human communication, like what people needed at that radio station, and you'll find out how unreal, how disconnected you are. The attacks against net neutrality are further examples of trying to disconnect the masses of people, because they see that there's certain elements within the world population that are using the internet in ways outside of so-called Second Life, but are trying to connect on a human scale with ideas, so on and so forth. But of course, that can't be tolerated. So what ends up happening to those of the town of Mayotte? Well, just listen to these 9/11 tapes as they keep calling in the confusion of the matrix that they found themselves in.
911 emergency.
I called a while ago about a power outage and ammonia smell.
Well, you just need to stay in your house with the doors and windows closed until we direct you differently.
Well, how would we find out?
We will get that out on cable TV or the KCJB radio.
Because our electricity's out, so
yeah.
We can get TV.
Okay. What about a radio?
Well, we have a little transistor.
Okay. That would be the thing to use then.
But what channel?
KCJB 910.
910?
Yes.
910. Okay.
Yes. Okay.
We'll try that thing.
Emergency.
We're getting gassed.
Stay in the house.
I can't breathe.
Okay, listen to me. I'll tell you what to do to help you. Okay? Stay in your house. Keep your doors and windows closed.
My God, what's going on out here?
Are you listening to me, sir?
I'm outside the street.
Well, get in the house.
Huh?
Get in the house.
What is it?
I'm not sure, but you need to get in the house.
Okay.
Right now.
Okay.
Okay.
We're dropping dead in here.
Are you in the house?
Yeah, I'm going in the house. Now what do we do?
Okay, just stay there until we direct you differently. If you've got a radio, listen to 910 KCJB radio, 910 AM, okay?
Okay.
911 emergency.
Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. Ammonia smell.
Yeah, there's a train derailment west of town. Stay in your house with the doors and windows closed, and we'll direct you when we have other directions for you.
Over what media?
Probably either an EBS radio, KCJB radio, or cable TV system.
Okay.
911, what is your emergency?
Well, I'm wondering about this anhydrous.
Sir, you stay in your home. Treat it like smoke. Turn your furnace off. Put towels underneath the door. Go in your bathroom. Turn the shower on and cover your face with wet towels.
Okay.
And stay there until further instructions by law enforcement.
Because the PA system doesn't work in it.
I understand that, and also we've been putting it on over the cable TV and the radio.
Which radio station?
All the radio stations, sir.
I have had it on. I haven't heard it once.
Twenty years ago, these little corporate thugs were allowed to have one AM station and one FM station in a single market. Now the corporations want to own 10 to 12 stations. It's already been expanded, as we all know. In the past, no company could own more than 40 stations in the country. Today, Clear Channel owns 1,200 radio stations. Of the six stations in Mayotte, all of them had the same phone number. This is automated virtual community programming. And programming is the operative word. Clear Channel claims they had someone there, but they were flooded with calls. Well, if that was the case, why didn't the person simply just go on the air and announce what was going on? Of course, now Clear Channel is trying to reprogram the issue in their direction and blame it on everyone but themselves. Of course, our friends at the FCC did nothing concerning Clear Channel's own violation by not having anyone at these stations, and the fact that it was proven that these virtual stations are a detriment to populations. But we all know that the FCC is more interested in crashing in on pirate radio stations and trying to close us down. Clear Channel also owns a number of syndicated networks. It has all these various programs, you know, Limbaugh, O'Reilly, they're all, you know, syndicated. They're syndicated on more than half of the radio stations throughout the country. This is part of locking people into the mind sphere of the corporatocracy. Clear Channel also does bulk advertising and has live concert venues. So it can basically discipline, because it owns so many stations, the artists by negating not only the access that the artists have on the airwaves, but what venues they have when they want to perform live. This is tied into, of course, deregulation and crime Bill Clinton's Telecommunication Act of 1996. At one time, there was an upsurge of people of color voices in this little corporate media mantra. Even though we know its vast limitations within that, even that was not acceptable, because there's been a drop by 40%. In the United States of America, 33% of the population is people of color, black, Latino, East Indian, etc. 3% of the people on the airway are now persons of color. And we know, for the most part, what type of persons they are. Modified, mulattified, coons, buffoons, and Looney Tunes. So while the gumpified masses are dropping out of active human measures to secure themselves to form true human forms of happiness, survival, etc., they are logging out into the virtual reality world and various book worlds of virtual reality that they can put their artificial face on. Book worlds like Facebook. But what's behind the Wizard of Virtual Reality Facebook constructs that are out there? Tom Hoskinson, article, January 17, 2008, called, "With Friends Like These, Facebook Has 59 Million Users and 2 Million New Ones Join Each Week." Goes something like this, quote, "I despise Facebook. This enormously successful American business describes itself as a social utility that connects you with people around you," quote unquote. But hang on, why on God's earth would I need a computer to connect me with the people around me? Why should my relationships be mediated through the imagination of a bunch of super geeks in California? What's wrong with the pub? And does Facebook really connect people? Doesn't it rather disconnect? Since instead of doing something enjoyable, such as talking and eating and dancing and drinking with my friends, I am merely sending them little ungrammatical notes and amusing photos in cyberspace while chained to my desk. A friend of mine recently told me that he spent a Saturday night at home alone on Facebook, drinking at his desk. What a gloomy image. Far from connecting us, Facebook actually isolates us at our workstations. Facebook appeals to a kind of vanity and self-importance, too. If I put up a flattering picture of myself with a list of my favorite things, I can construct an artificial representation of who I am in order to get sex or approval. Quote, "I like Facebook," said another friend. "I got a shag out of it." Unquote. It also encourages a disturbing competitiveness around friendship. It seems that with friends today, quality, quantity counts. It has nothing to do with quantity, with quality. Quantity counts for nothing, and quantity is king. The more friends you have, the better you are. You are popular, quote unquote. In a sense, much loved in American high schools. Witness the cover lines on Dennis Publishing New Face magazine. Quote, "How to double your friends list." It seems, though, that I am very much alone in my hostility. At the time of writing Facebook claims 59 million active users, including 7 million in the UK. Facebook's third biggest customer after the US and Canada. That's 59 million suckers, all of whom have volunteered their ID card information and consumer preferences to an American business they know nothing about. Right now, 2 million new people join each week. At the present rate of growth, Facebook will have more than 2 million active users by this time next year. And I would predict that, if anything, its rate of growth will accelerate over the coming months. As its spokesman Chris Hughes said, quote, "It's embedded itself to an extent where it's hard to get rid of," unquote. All of the above would have been enough to make me reject Facebook forever. But there are more reasons to hate it. Many more. Facebook is a well-funded project. And the people behind the funding, a group of Silicon Valley venture capitalists, have a clearly thought-out ideology that they are hoping to spread around the world. Facebook is one manifestation of this ideology. Like PayPal before it, it is a special experiment, an expression of a particular kind of neoconservative libertarianism. On Facebook, you can be free to be who you want to be, as long as you don't mind being bombarded by adverts for the world's biggest brands, as with PayPal's national boundaries are a thing of the past. Silicon Valley venture capitalist, one of the lead guys, is a 40-year-old futurist named Peter Thiel. But Thiel is more than just a clever and averageous capitalist. He is a futurist philosopher and neo-con activist. A philosophy graduate from Stanford in 1998, he co-wrote a book called The Diversity Myth, which is a detailed attack on liberalism and the multiculturalist ideology that dominated Stanford. He claimed that the multicultural, quote-unquote, led to a lessening of individual freedoms. While a student at Stanford, he funded a right-wing journal, still up and running, called the Stanford Review. His motto was, "Let there be light." Thiel's a member of the Vanguard, V-A-N-G-U-A-R-D, GUARD.org, an internet-based neoconservative pressure group that was set up to attack MoveOn.org, a liberal pressure group that works on the web. Thiel calls himself Way Libertarian. Now, we slaves all know that MoveOn is in the democratic wing of the Matrix order, as I outlined in my slave show, Snow Job. Continuing. The Vanguard is run by, Thiel's politics The Vanguard is run by Rod D. Martin, a philosopher capitalist whom Thiel greatly admires. On the site, Thiel says Rod is one of our nation's leading minds in the creation of new and needed ideas for public policy. He possesses a more complete understanding of America than most executives have on their own businesses. The little taster from their website will give you an idea of their vision of the world. The Vanguard.org is an online community of Americans who believe in conservative values, the free market, and limited government as the best means to bring hope and ever-increasing opportunities to everyone, especially the poorest among us, quote-unquote. Their aim is to promote policies that will reshape America and the globe, quote-unquote. The Vanguard describes his policies as Reaganite, Thatcherite, quote-unquote. The chairman's message says, quote, "Today we will teach MoveOn, the liberal website, Hillary, and the left-wing media some lessons they never imagined," unquote. So Thiel's politics are not in doubt. What about his philosophy? I listened to a podcast on an address Thiel gave about his ideas for the future. His philosophy, briefly, is that since the 17th century, certain enlightened thinkers have been taking the world away from the old-fashioned, nature-bound life. And here he quotes Thomas Hobbes' famous characterization that life as, quote, "nasty, brutish, and short," unquote, and towards a new virtual world where we have conquered nature. Values now exist in imaginary things. If life in the past was nasty, brutish, and short, then in the future, Thiel wants to make it much longer. And in this end, he has invested in a firm that is exploring life extension technologies. He has pledged $3.5 million to a Cambridge-based geological called Aubrey D. Gray, which is searching for the key to immortality. Thiel is also on the board of advisors of something called the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. from its fantastical website the following, quote, "The singularity is the technological creation of smarter than human intelligence. There are several technologies heading in this direction: artificial intelligence, direct brain computer interfaces, genetic engineering. Different technologies which, if they reach the threshold level of sophistication, could enable the creation of smarter than human intelligence." So by his own admission, Thiel is trying to destroy the real world, which he also calls nature, and install a virtual world in its place. And in this context, that is what must be viewed on the rise of Facebook. Facebook is a deliberate experiment in global manipulation, and Thiel is a bright young thing in the neoconservative pantheon with a penchant for far-out technological utopian fantasies. Not someone I want to help get richer. Also, as we slaves know, that they don't deal in the virtual world when it comes to finance. They want stay monies. You know what I'm saying? They're not venture capitalists, material capitalists for nothing. You know, they just want you in the haze of giving up, trying to get earthly pleasures and trying to define what your earthly pleasures should be and going about getting them, and then this droning out and emulating them in their quote-unquote virtual reality. So with all of these, so where do all these market-based virtual realities systems end up besides in their pocketbooks? Because we know one thing, like I said, their dollars are not virtual. We'll continue with the article. Facebook's most recent round of funding was led by a company called Greylock Venture Capital, who put in a sum of $27.5 million. One of Greylock's senior partners is called Howard Cox, another former chairman of the NVCA, who is also on the board of NQTEL. What is NQTEL? Well, believe it or not, this is the venture capitalist wing of the CIA. An intel which identifies, quote-unquote, and partners with companies developing cutting-edge technologies to help deliver these solutions to the Central Intelligence Agency and a broader U.S. intelligence community to further their missions, unquote. The creators of the site need to do very little but bar fiddle with the program. In the main, they simply sit back and watch as millions of Facebook addicts voluntarily upload their ID details, photographs, and lists of their favorite consumer objects. Once in receipt of the vast database of human beings, Facebook then simply has to sell the information back to advertisers, or as Zuckerberg puts it in a recent blog post, quote, "to try to help people share information with their friends about things they do on the web," unquote. And indeed, this is precisely what's happening. On November 6th last year, Facebook announced that 12 global brands had climbed aboard. They include Coca-Cola, Blockbuster, Verizon, Sony Pictures. All trained in marketing bullshit on the highest order. Their representatives made excited comments along the following lines. In closing on this Facebook article, also what should be noted is that opting out of Facebook doesn't mean opting out. As it states, quote, "Facebook reserves the right to send you notices about your account even if you opt out of all voluntary email notifications," unquote. And also that the CIA has access to your stuff. Quote, "By using Facebook, you are consenting to have your personal data transferred to and processed in the United States. We may be required to disclose user information pursuant to lawful requests, such as subpoenas or court orders, or in compliance with equitable laws. We do not reveal information until we have a good faith belief that an information request by law enforcement or private litigants meets applicable legal standards. Additionally, we may share accounts or other information when we believe it is necessary to comply with law, to protect our interests or property, to prevent fraud or other illegal activity penetrating through the Facebook services or using the Facebook name, or to prevent imminent bodily harm. This may include sharing information with other companies, lawyers, agents, governments, and government agencies. So check this out, slaves. If or when the CIA or the FBI comes to render your behind, or to torture your behind, believe me, it won't be your virtual self. The Order, this imperial beast, isn't sending out virtual G.I. Joes and Janes to conquer Iraq, the Middle East, and Eurasia. It's time to wake up. But, as we have seen with Rick, Dutch, in his second life, Blue Pill Virtual World, many in the world of Facebook, MySpace, Stout World, and many YouTuber types, not all YouTubers that way, of course, but some, it's clear that many are lost within their own dream world that's been created by someone else. Meaning like the venture capitalists, who are growing and breeding their own version of human beings as they liquefy our very souls.
There are fields, endless fields, where human beings are no longer born. Time I wouldn't believe it. And then I saw the fields with my own eyes. Watched them liquefy the dead so they could be fed intravenously to the living. And standing there, facing the pure, horrifying precision, I came to realize the obviousness of the truth.
What is the Matrix?
Control.
The Matrix is a computer-generated dream world, built to keep us under control in order to change a human being into this.
You know, I got suspended yesterday by YouTube. Yeah. I got suspended, man. Woo-wee! YouTube suspended Mr. Pregnant. No big deal. No. I just, you know, create a new account. I'll be back up there. I'll be back up there, guys. I just create a new account. Sign up Mr. Pregnant and Mr. Pregnanty, or Mr. Pregnant Returns, or Mr. Pregnant makes a comeback, and I could do that, and I'll be right back. You know, I'll have all my subscribers, I'll have all my fans, I'll have all my I've got all the people that were stressed out, all the people that were depressed, all the people that were all the people that were suicidal, all the hundreds of emails where people say, man, I love seeing your videos, keep making those videos. I mean, all I need to do is just create an account and be back again. Everything will be fixed. You know, I still think that YouTube made a mistake. It has to be a mistake. It's not like This. I can't believe it. All this. All this work, man. It's like, oh. All this work I've done, you guys just gonna just come take it away. You know, if Mr. Prater, we can take his stuff away. We can just take his videos now, you know? 2 years. 2 long years. 2 years making videos on this site. It's not a big deal. 50 million people see my videos. And YouTube decided to suspend my account because of what? One video I upload to YouTube. Mr. Pregnant of VH1. Viacom copyright infringement violation. So YouTube decides to suspend my account. Why, man? Why? I'm not a threat. I'm no harm. I'm not gonna kill anyone. I'm not some kind of crazy person that's gonna destroy anyone. I'm just having fun. If you guys wanna take a video down, then take it down. Take one video down, but you guys don't have to suspend my account. I can't believe this. Videos all taken down because you guys don't like what I uploaded.
Now this is some sad stuff. This is a Negro clown, male, grown, crying because his little YouTube account got suspended. This Mr. Pregnant, a grown Negro male, crying, and then talking about, we can take his stuff away, and all of that, not realizing that you feeling this is not justified. Sorry, Negro, it's not your stuff. It is not your stuff. It is not your stuff. He's so deeply caught up in the Matrix that he doesn't realize that once he gets involved in all of that, they own, I mean, it's, they could do what they want. If they want to delete your stuff, suspend your account, they can. Why? Because it's your Matrix masters. So if they feel that you have done some infringement, you know, Viacom infringement violations as they claim, well, you have to realize they're a corporation. This is how they operate. This is how they deal with things. But when you're so caught up and deprogrammed from understanding the world for how it really is. Then you whine about how your account was suspended because you guys don't like what I uploaded. But if you stepped out of the virtual reality and faced the real world of the corporations and their marketing goals and competition and how they demand obedience, you'll see that there's a direct parallel between the same way that Clear Channel responded to artists who stepped out of line of their little corporate agenda. How Clear Channel put out a hit list of songs they did not want played. But this drone doesn't even know the reality that he's really in and how deep he's locked within this whole mindset. And actually, he's crying to get back in it. While at the same time, as a Time article, April 13th, Friday, 2007, outline, it says, researchers exploring scrapping internet. And what this goes into is that the various powers that be are making excuses that the internet needs to be re-scrapped and they need to, you know, set up a new internet system, basically so that they can track people more easily, set it up in a more hierarchical formation, and content that is deemed problematic, i.e. true human conscious content, will be relegated to the slower uploading mechanisms, while the proper stuff, the Fox and so on and so forth, that mantra will have access to the free-willing high lanes. Net neutrality is under attack. Plus, it'll be more easily and able to monitor people if they get what they wish about scrapping the internet and reconstructing it as the Internet 2 setup. So this is the mechanisms that are going on and what people should really be focusing on, who of course use the internet in ways that are ways to enhance the human condition. But if you're a drone like Mr. Pregnant, well, that's the furthest thing from your mind. Now, continuing on with Back to Dutch. The real Mr. Hoogestraat, Mrs. Hoogestraat, you know, Rick's wife, is no stranger to online communities. She met her husband in a computer chat room 3 years ago. Both were divorced and had adult children from previous marriages. And Ms. Hoogestraat says she was relieved to find someone educated and adventurous after years of failed relationships. Now, as she pays household bills, cooks, does laundry, takes care of their three dogs and empties ashtrays around the house while her husband spends hours designing outfits for virtual strippers and creating labels for virtual coffee cups, she wonders what happened to the person she married. One Saturday night in early June, she discovered his cyber wife. He called her over to the computer to show her an outfit he had designed. There above the image of the red-headed model, it said, Mrs. Hoogebeek, quote unquote. When she confronted him, he huffily replied that it was just a game. 2 weeks later, Mrs. Hoogestraat joined an online support group for spouses of obsessive online gamers called EverQuest Widows, named after another popular online fantasy game that players call Evercrack. Quote, it's avalanche beyond repair, says Sherard Goodart, 30 years old, Mrs. Hoogestraat's daughter, and a sign language interpreter in Chandler, Arizona. She says she and her two brothers have offered to help their mother move out of the house. Mrs. Hoogestraat says she's not ready to separate. I'm not a monster. I can see how it fulfills parts of his life that he can no longer do because of the physical limitations, because of his age. His avatar is him at 25, she says. He's a good person. He's just fallen down. The rabbit hole.
That system is our enemy. When you're inside, you look around, what do you see? Businessmen, teachers, lawyers, carpenters, the very minds of the people we are trying to save. But until we do, these people are still a part of that system, and that makes them our enemy. You have to understand, most of these people are not ready to be unplugged. And many of them are so inert, so hopelessly dependent on the system, that they will fight to protect it.
If you look at that most famous of photographs from Abu Ghraib, of the Iraqi standing on the box, arms extended, with a hood over his head, and the fake electrical wires from his arms, okay? In that photograph, you can see the entire 50-year history of CIA torture. It's very simple. He's hooded for sensory disorientation, and his arms are extended for self-inflicted pain. And those are the two very simple, fundamental CIA techniques developed at enormous cost. From 1950 to 1962, the CIA ran a massive research project, a veritable Manhattan Project of the mind, spending over $1 billion a year to crack the code of human consciousness from both mass persuasion and the use of coercion in individual interrogation. And what they discovered, they tried LSD, they tried mescaline, they tried all kinds of drugs, they tried electroshock, truth serum, sodium pentothal, none of it worked. What worked was very simple behavioral findings outsourced to our leading universities, Harvard, Princeton, Yale, McGill. And the first breakthrough came at McGill. Very simple. Dr. Donald O'Hebb of McGill University, a brilliant psychologist, had a contract from the Canadian Defense Research Board, which was a partner with the CIA in this research. And he found that he could induce a state of psychosis in an individual within 48 hours. It didn't take electroshock, truth serum, beating or pain. All he did was had student volunteers sit in a cubicle with goggles, gloves, and headphones, earmuffs, so that they were cut off from their senses. And within 48 hours, denied sensory stimulation, they would suffer first hallucinations, then ultimately breakdown. And if you look at many of those photographs, what do they show? They show people with bangs over their head. If you look at the photographs of the Guantanamo detainees even today, they look exactly like those student volunteers in Dr. Hebb's original cubicle. Now, then the second major breakthrough that the CIA had came here in New York City at Cornell University Medical Center, where two eminent neurologists under contract from the CIA studied Soviet KGB torture techniques, and they found that the most effective KGB technique was self-inflicted pain. You simply make somebody stand for a day or two, and as they stand, okay, you're not beating them, they have no resentment. You tell them, you're doing this to yourself. Cooperate with us, and you can sit down. And so, as they stand, what happens is the fluids flow down to the legs swell, lesions form, they erupt, they separate, hallucinations start, the kidneys shut down. Now, if you look at the other aspect of those photos, you'll see that they're short shackled, okay, that they're long shackled. One of them with a man up with a bag on his arm, his arms are straight in front of him. People are standing with their arms extended. That's self-inflicted pain. And the combination of those two techniques, sensory disorientation and self-inflicted pain, is the basis of the CIA's technique.
Sensory deprivation and self-inflicted pain, covering one's ears, eyes, mouths, forced to stand, forced to be in a stationary type position. This droning out in the virtual world's second life, in these forms of second happiness, second religions, is a form of sensory deprivation, self-isolating, self-inflicting to create dehumanization and a form of painless pain. Just like the boys at Facebook and the CIA want. just like the intelligence operators want. Whether you're doing it on a blue screen filled fantasy land, or whether they are physically doing it to you in one of their torture gulags, it's all the same players for the same economic domination, political control, and interests. And what are they about? Well, as one of their henchmen from Facebook even said, to destroy nature. But to destroy nature is to destroy humanity, because humanity is nature. Continuing on with the Rick episode, Dutch. We have Mr. Hookerstrat, for his part, doesn't feel he's being unfaithful. Quote, she watches TV and I do this. He says, I tried to get her involved so we can play together, but she wasn't interested. Some gamers say the addictive dangers have been overstated, citing surveys that show most players spend fewer hours online than the average American spends watching TV. And unlike television, online games are social. In June, when Mr. Hookerstrat first logged on to Second Life after he had his gallbladder removed, he was greeted with 50 messages from virtual friends asking him how the surgery went. Meanwhile, his real-life wife, who was taking care of him, that relationship is deteriorating. That's part of the point. So while he's zoning out about the virtual response, in the real world, Sue, his real life, is feeling more isolated, more abused, more disrespected. And please, don't compare, use television as an example of what second lifers do. Television is not a criterion people should be using. This is real sad. But then again, let's look at it from another way. Let's go over to, you know, an Islam land. You know, the hocus pocus stuff. Another form of virtual reality. to see if we can find some answers on this isolation of one's humanity. In other words, does this hocus pocusism have an answer to isolation to humanity and low self-esteem? Or are people who live there just like the Ricks of the world, who create their superhero virtual reality to counter what is happening in their real lives as they buy various forms of body parts?
Private clinics in Tehran specializing in plastic surgery are no different than anywhere else in the world. What sets these clinics apart is the sheer number of people undergoing cosmetic procedures. In the past few years, the number of people in Iran choosing plastic surgery has gone up drastically. Nose jobs in particular have become major status symbols. So much so that people often joke about a poor teenager covering his nose in bandages and pretending to just have surgery to try and impress the girls. Dr. Mohsen Narafi is one of many plastic surgery specialists here in the Iranian capital. The patient he's operating on wants to change his face to look like a famous rock star. The doctor says his request is not unusual. He's simply part of a wider trend.
This phenomenon has social, cultural, scientific, and medical reasons. Some people want to change their faces and look exactly like a chosen celebrity. We do not accept all cases, and I consider the new tendency dangerous, as it has led to a growing number of unqualified surgeons in Iran, which has resulted in a rising number of facial disfigurement cases.
This young woman wants a new nose, both for medical and aesthetic reasons.
I look and my nose does not go in harmony with my face. In addition, I want to get rid of breathing problems.
In clinics like this, a surgeon might carry out as many as 6 procedures per day. and prices range from $500 to more than $10,000. Most of the procedures are relatively cheap, and the low prices are adding to the appeal.
So far, there has been no religious opposition to the use of plastic surgery, even though some would see it as pandering to the Western idea of the body beautiful. While a police crackdown on un-Islamic outfits and hairstyles is underway, it seems that the number of young men and women on the streets wearing bandages to protect their recently operated European-style noses is on the rise. So whatever the pressure of the religion or the government, the quest for beauty in Iran today appears unstoppable. Ali Reza Ronavi, Al Jazeera, Tehran.
So as you can see, isolation is all over. And these religions, which is another form of virtual reality, in many ways help play into it. As you have people in Tehran running around trying to get noses like Brad Pitt and Angela Jolie. And even the little top clerics in Tehran aren't raising opposition, because they're probably getting them too, and for their wives and daughters and mistresses and so on and so forth. So this so-called quest for beauty is a virtual beauty. It's a virtual reality. Who's defining this beauty? Continuing on with the Dutch episode. Back in the world of Second Life, Mr. Hoekstra's avatar and Tanaj have gotten bored at the beast, so they teleport to his office. A second floor room with a large tinted window overlooking the stage of the script club he owns. Tanaj plays with her pug, Jolly Rogers, commanding a dog to sit and fetch his toy. Dutch drinks a Corona, Mr. Hoekstra's beer of choice in real life, and sits at his desk. For a while, Mr. Hoekstra, sitting at his computer, stares at an image of his avatar sitting at his computer. The next morning, he's at his computer at 10 a.m., wearing the same black Harley Davidson t-shirt. It is Sunday. He's been logged on to Second Life for 4 hours. Staring purposefully at the screen, he manipulates his avatar, who is shirtless in clean and cut-off denim shorts and flip-flops, and renovating the lower level of his mall. Sunday is my heavy-duty workday, quote-unquote, Mr. Hoekstra explains. Early that morning, he evicted 10 shop owners who hadn't paid rent and signed up 4 new vendors, including an avatar named Arena, who sells virtual necklaces and women's shoes. From the kitchen, Mrs. Hoekstra asked if he wants breakfast. He doesn't answer. She sets a plate of breakfast pockets on the computer console and goes into the living room to watch a dog competition on television. For 2 hours, he focuses intently on building a coffee shop for the mall. 2 other avatars gather to watch as he builds stairs and a counter, using his cursor to resize wooden planks. At 12:05, he's ready for a break. He changes his avatar into jeans, leather motorcycle chaps, and motorcycle gloves, and teleports to a place with a curvy mountain road. It's one of his favorite places for riding his Harley lookalike. The road is empty. He weaves his motorcycle across the lane. Sunlight glints off the ocean in the distance. Mrs. Hoekstra pauses on her way to the kitchen and glances at the screen. "You didn't eat your breakfast," she says. "I'm sorry, I didn't see it there," he responds. "They probably won't taste any good now," she says, taking a plate. Over the next 5 hours, Mr. Hoekstrat, Rick Dutch, stares at the computer screen, barely aware of his physical surroundings. He adds a coffee maker and potted palms to the cafe, goes swimming through a sunken castle off the waterfront property, chats with friends at a biker club house, meets a store owner at the mall, counsels an avatar friend who recently split up with her avatar boyfriend, and shows his wife Tanaj the coffee shop he built. By 4 p.m., he's been in Second Life for 10 hours, pausing only to go to the bathroom. His wrists and fingers ache from manipulating the mouse to draw logos for his virtual coffee shop. His back hurts. He feels it's worth the effort. Quote, if I work a little harder and make it a little nicer, it's more rewarding. Unquote, he says. Sitting alone in the living room in the front of the television, Mrs. Hoogerstrat says she worries it will be years before her husband realizes that he's traded his real life for the Pollux's fantasy's existence, one that doesn't include her. Quote, basically, the other person is widowed, she says. This other life is so wonderful. It's better than real life. Nobody gets fat. Nobody gets gray. The person that's left can't compete with that. Unquote. So as the Gumps continue, especially in America, to get beat down in real life, they cyber over to their second blue pill, blue screen life, where you stand tall in the cage of Dutch, remember 6'9", emulating your real life corporate masters in your utopian capitalist fantasy. In America's virtual world, the second life's only place where some of these people like Dutch can stand tall anymore.
Americans might have a growing problem, or more specifically, a problem growing. A new study shows that compared to the rest of the world, we're just not as tall as we used to be. The reason? Well, it's not the population's changing ethnic mix, as some might think, but rather the way we live.
Americans like to think we walk tall and stand tall. And starting in the days of 6'2" George Washington, we were tall, the tallest nation in the world.
Ever since colonial times, Americans were the tallest.
But now we're coming up short. The world's tallest country, the land of tulips and wooden shoes, the Netherlands. Dutchmen average 6'1", that's without the wooden shoes. In Denmark, men average 6 feet, and American men, 5'10".
But there's no way I want the Dutch towering over the United States of America.
Why the big case of Honey, I Shrunk America? Height says a lot about a country's well-being.
How long does it live? How well does it live? How healthy it is reflected in human height.
Researchers say the Dutch healthcare system might take better care of children when they're young, when most growing takes place. Another reason might be the American diet, filled with fast food. Overeating can cause kids to produce too much growth hormone too early and stop growing at a younger age. Outside McDonald's, young Jacob said the news will make him think twice about going to the Netherlands or Denmark.
It's going to make me feel horrible. It's going to feel like this is where I come to Europe for, to see taller people.
Of course, 5'9" Tracy had a different reaction.
If men are here getting shorter, then I need to move to Denmark.
You know, without all the unhealthy food I've eaten, I might be 6'8 instead of 6'4 like I am. To give you a sense of how much things have changed, in 1850, Americans were 2 inches taller than the Dutch. Now, we're 3 inches shorter. That's a 5-inch swing.
All right, 6'4 in an apple box, maybe. Oh, my God.
So as many drones continue to grow in the virtual world, they continue to shrink in the real world, literally, but they continue to invest in an illusion, the illusion of America, of the privatized markets, of the system that they are in. They're just a cartoon. They're an image of someone else's imagination on someone else's hard drive. The healthcare system, how happy people really are, how well people are really eating, all takes its toll in the real world. And you can see it in the 5-inch swing since colonial times to the reality that we face today. Even Many of America's icons are falling off. Colleen Logg, July 1st, Marvel comic buries Captain America. Yes, folks, Captain America is dead and buried in the latest issue of Marvel Comics, Fallen Sun, due on newsstands the morning after Independence Day. After 66 years of battling villains from Adolf Hitler to the Red Skull, the red, white, and blue leader of the Avengers was felled by an assassin's bullets on the steps of the New York Federal Courthouse. He was headed to court after refusing to sign the government's Superhero Registration Act, a move that would have revealed his true identity. A sniper who fired from a rooftop was captured as police and Captain America's military escort were left to cope with the chaos in the streets. But the sniper didn't act alone and didn't even fire the shot that killed Captain. Basically, they're making a commentary about what's going on in the war on quote-unquote terror, the whole Big Brother apparatus. Even the comic book writers are saying, what's the point? There's no use trying to pull the illusion any longer. America's a sham. In essence, the Matrix is utopian capitalism. Is anti-nature and anti-human, a market-based system and programming that they call civilization, their version of civilization. Being in the Matrix is being a Democrat, a Republican. It's being part of the construct of whiteness, being caught up in their version of race, their version of gender, being caught up in celebrityism. If you log on in, you will fall so deep down the rabbit hole that one day you yourself may pathetically be sounding like this.
And how fucking dare anyone out there make fun of Britney after all she's been through? She lost her aunt. She went through a divorce. She had two fucking kids. Her husband turned out to be a user, a cheater, and now she's going through a custody battle. All you people care about is readers and making money off of her. She's a human! What you don't realize is that Britney's making you all this money and all you do is write a bunch of crap about her. She hasn't performed on stage in years. Her song is called Give Me More for a reason, because all you people want is more, 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 more! Leave her alone! You're lucky she even performed for you bastards! Leave Britney alone! Please. Perez Hilton talked about professionalism and said if Britney was a professional, she would have pulled it off no matter what. Speaking of professionalism, when is it professional to publicly bash someone who's going through a hard time? Leave Britney alone! Please! Leave Britney Spears alone right now! I mean it. Anyone who has a problem with her, you deal with me. Because she's not well right now. Leave her alone.
This is Chris YouTube Crocker's diatribe on Britney Spears' performance that was ridiculed celebrityism, isolation, voyeurism, materialism, hocus-pocusisms, utopian capitalism have taken their toll where people's lives are consumed and fulfilled in the void of cyber reality. Ignorance is not bliss, sisters and brothers, as we can see. It helps turn you into an incredibly shrinking being, and we will continue to be helpless slaves as long as the order and its matrix complex exists. We must free our minds. Remain or become unplugged. That's the hard reality. But we all know, once you enter the slave resistant corridors, you can't go back. Until the next time, slave out.
Can't go back, can I?
No. But if you could, would you really want to? I feel I owe you an apology. We have a rule. We never free a mind once it's reached a certain age. It's dangerous. The mind has trouble letting go. I've seen it before, and I'm sorry. I did what I did because I had to. As long as the Matrix exists, the human race will never be free. As long as the Matrix exists, the human race will never be free. As long as the Matrix exists, the human race will never be free. As long as the Matrix exists, the human race will never be free. As long as the Matrix exists, the human race will never be free.